Welcome, everyone. My name is Ed, and you're listening to the second episode of the Checked Out podcast, that is Check Ed Out, for those of you who haven't worked that one out yet. Here we're talking about meaningful books, and when I say meaningful, I mean subjectively meaningful, books that have a message or raise some questions that I feel I've directly struggled with in my own experience. This podcast, I should say, is not a review podcast. It's not a critique podcast. I'm not critiquing books from a literary standpoint. I'm not qualified for that. This is purely a platform for me to talk about books that I love and that I don't love, potentially. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't already. Apple Podcasts is coming. Spotify is also coming. I know I said last week they were both available. They're taking a bit of time to process. That could be because there's other Checked Out podcasts on Apple Podcasts, I now realize, but this is the superior one, or at least I hope it will be. So at this point, you're going to have to install Anchor to be able to listen to this podcast. There's actually a number of other platforms that this podcast is available on. I'll link them in the show notes, but I'm guessing that, you know, the majority of my listener base here, all, you know, 20 of you, or however many there are likely listening to this on Anchor. So, that's still the reality of the situation at the moment. Be sure to leave feedback. I've got plenty of excellent feedback, about my pronunciation of certain words. I'm sorry. It's a bit difficult to sort of correct yourself while you're talking to a microphone. What else? I'm going to talk about the books a bit more. I'm going to describe the books a bit more. That's another piece of feedback I've got. Obviously, I'm reading books that potentially the majority of you haven't read before or haven't read recently. So I'll be sure to just give a bit more of an in-depth description about each book and what's inside it. But other than that, I hear the audio quality's good. Hopefully, you'll notice a difference in this one too, because I'm messing around with Adobe Audition and just trying to fine-tune that a little bit. So hopefully this one, the sound balancing is a bit better and the content is a bit better. Before getting into the text I'm going to talk about this week, I'll just give you a sort of overview, quick overview of what's to come. So this weekend I read a couple of books, but the first of which was The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, who you'll remember from last week when we talked about Robert Greene's book. I would love to do a podcast where I talk about The Prince, Niccolo Machiavelli's text, talking about the rise and consolidation of power, paired with The Leopard by Tomasi di Lampedusa, which is a very famous book about the decline of power. Both texts are written by Italian authors. Both texts are about the Italian peninsula and European realpolitik, in a sense, and both are very interesting books. So I haven't read The Leopard yet this year. I've read it, I think it was 2 years ago. I've just got my copy from home back in Adelaide. So I'll be reading that, and hopefully you'll get a podcast on power next week. The next podcast after that I'd like to talk about, it's a bit more complicated. The first book I'll be reading in there is The Trial, or Das Trial, by Kafka. A bit of a nihilist text, depending on where you're from, I guess. The second text in that will probably be The Outsider by Albert Camus, just because I have to talk about it. If you know me, you know that's one of my favorite books. I can't stop talking about it. And I'm not alone in that. So if you haven't read it, do read it. It's good fun. It'll take you less than a day to read. Highly recommend that book. And the third book I would like to include in that, potentially, is Existentialism as a Humanism, in English. There's a French title, of course. And in fact, all three of these books are translations. So there's something. And that's by Jean-Paul Sartre. I think that's how you pronounce it. So I'm going to talk about that. And as you can probably tell from those texts, if you know anything about them, that's going to be a pretty trippy episode about absurdism, existentialism, and nihilism, sort of all amalgamating. So, if that interests you at all, or if you've read any of those books or haven't, again, all these books are quite short. Like, you could finish these in a day or two, depending on how much time you have. The third podcast, and I'm not sure if this will directly follow after that week. I'm not too sure. It's going to be a complicated one. The texts I've chosen for that podcast are The Communist Manifesto by Engels and Marx, obviously, which I've just purchased from the Penguin Great Ideas series, which I talked a bit about last week, rather, and pairing that with the Gulag Archipelago by, and I'm going to butcher Russian names throughout this series, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, I think is how you pronounce it. Very famous book. Kind of the, I've heard it described as almost the anti-communist manifesto, sort of the antithesis or the breakdown of what is the reality of Marx's doctrine. And of course, if you know anything about the most recent edition of that book, it's an abridged edition that I've just got with a foreword by Jordan B. Peterson. So think of him what you will. He knows his Marxist doctrine and it sounds like a fantastic read. So I would love to do a podcast. It may get a little political, but I don't think so. Sort of comparing that, the Communist Manifesto and the Gulag Archipelago. But I can't promise that will be directly after my crazy existential podcast because I believe that one deserves a bit of time, a bit of thought. I'd like to talk to a few other people about some of the ideas from that comparison before recording a podcast on that. So that's what's to come. But in this episode, we're going to dark places with Joseph Conrad. And the text that I've chosen, a controversial one, but a very interesting one, it's only about 96 pages long, is Heart of Darkness. And if you haven't read it, I will warn you that this podcast is going to get a little dark. And if you do read the book is very dark. I'm not going to do it any justice, but it's a fantastic book in my mind, I think. And this lesson or this theme of going to dark places, the descent to dark places, is a very interesting one. So I hope you enjoy this episode where I'll be talking about Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. So what is the book about? It begins with the narrator, who is unnamed, sitting on a boat with a number of crew members. And one of the crew members begins to talk, and his name is Marlowe. And Marlowe tells a tale of sorts, describing his journey to the heart of the Congo. And he describes this journey as a descent into the heart of darkness. So already you might be thinking, that sounds a bit controversial. Africa, darkness, colonialism. This is a post-colonial text, so you'll get those vibes as we move forward. On his journey, Marlowe experiences a number of things. He begins to see things that challenge his perception of what people or what the white man is doing in Africa. You know, he's been brought up with the prevalent doctrine at the time. He believes that they are light bringers, bringers of civilization to an uncivilized people. And very quickly, he realizes this is not the case. On this journey, he hears of a man called Kurtz, Mr. Kurtz, who at the beginning, we believe, is more or less the embodiment of imperial idealism. He believes in the bringing of the light. He believes he's there. He's a great man. He's going to civilize the country. And many of the people that Marlowe comes across either fully believe in him and his idealism or hate him. In fact, some say that he should be killed for how he acts. Upon finding Kurtz, however, Marlowe realizes that he's a decrepit man, obsessed with accumulating wealth in the form of ivory, and he subjugates many of the native tribes around his station to absolute unbridled cruelty. And upon discussing things with Kurtz, very short things, I might add, Marlowe realizes many things about both the mission in Africa himself, and it gets very dark at this point. Kurtz is sick, and I'm going to spoil the book for you. He eventually dies as they're taking him out of the depth of the Congo. And he mutters these famous last words to Marlowe, the horror, the horror, in a moment of, well, Marlowe believes absolute clarity and honesty, but we'll get to that when we discuss what hell looks like from Conrad's point of view. And the book ends with Marlowe visiting Kurtz's betrothed in the Sepulchre City. I believe it's in Belgium somewhere. And he lies to her about Kurtz's last words. He says that his last words were her name. And this preserves a false memory of a man who he feels indebted to. So that's a description of the book. I would read even a summary, perhaps just before you listen to the rest of this podcast, if you want to know more, or better yet, read the book. But as you can see, the book is quite short. It's structured into three parts, which some have alluded to. This actually mirrors another text we might talk about briefly here, that is Dante's Inferno, which is also in three parts and is also about a descent into literally hell.
Poses itself,
that is the theme, to a reader, posed itself to me as I was reading this book, was what dark places do we go in life? And without too much experience in these things, I think I've been able to identify at least three dark places that we tend to go. The first is physically dark places, and I don't mean places with the lights off. I mean horribly dark places. In this book, for Marlowe, that dark place was the Congo, a place where the imperialists were perhaps attempting, or were told that they were bringing light to a horrible place, civilization to a uncivilized place. But, of course, this was not the case. And Marlowe realizes this soon into his journey and has to deal with that. The second dark places that we might go are those within our mind, mentally dark places. And there's a quote here that I think embodies what happens to Marlowe as a result of his experience in the Congo from a mental aspect. "No, they did not bury me, though there is a period of time which I remember mistily with a shuddering wonder, like a passage through some inconceivable world that had no hope in it and no desire. I found myself back in the sepulchral city, resenting the sight of people hurrying through the streets to filch a little money from each other, to devour their infamous cookery, to gulp their unwholesome beer, to dream their insignificant and silly dreams. I dare say I was not well at the time. I toddered about the streets. There were various affairs to settle. I admit my behaviour was inexcusable." Marlowe's dark place seems, perhaps if you were to contrast it with those people in Africa, the Africans, the Congo natives, it may seem not of any worthy comparison. But I think this book does raise perhaps an interesting thought, somewhat related, that everyone's problems are arbitrary to another's, in a sense. Kurtz's pain at the end of the book, Marlowe's pain throughout the book, seem almost arbitrary to the shadows that are pushed to the side, the actual Africans who are being subjugated to imperial rule. But at the same time, these problems seem to weigh just as heavily on those men as they do on the Africans. And I think the real interesting point on mentally dark places is that everyone's problems are arbitrary until someone dies, until the problem gets the best of that person. And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about Seneca's book last week. But I think there is something to be learned about the power of mentally dark places, and that these dark places are not based on the actual, perhaps, physical, the physical horribleness, or the comparatively horrible aspects of those thoughts, because the conclusion can always be the same. Someone can die. Someone can lose all hope. And I think this alludes itself somewhat through this book, and I hope to talk about that thought a bit more later. The third, and perhaps the most important dark place that we visit in Heart of Darkness, is that of the spiritually dark place. And this is a deeper kind of dark place, I think. This is truly hell from Conrad's point of view. Kurtz, for example, goes there. His image of himself, his feeling of who he is pulled back as he enters the Congo. And this degradation reveals to Kurtz in a moment of absolute clarity at the end of his life how hollow, or perhaps how full he is, but full of something he's not proud of. And in the end, this drives him mad, drives his soul mad, as Marlowe describes in his own words, because a confrontation with the spiritually dark places in our own souls, I suppose, if you believe in that kind of thing, is perhaps the most difficult of the three dark places that we go in life. It truly is hell. So, leading on from that, I suppose, it begs the question, what does hell look like to people? And in this case, what does hell look like to Conrad? Distilling Conrad's perception of hell and the descent to hell is quite difficult, and I think purposely so. Conrad's book's been called by literary critics somewhat ambiguous, and some have pointed out this is fantastic, and some have said perhaps the opposite. In my mind, Conrad's hell is constructed with lies, and it punishes those inside of it by peeling back those lies one by one until the hollow man, the man worthy of punishment, is left with nothing. And in this case, there is no worse punishment for a man like Kurtz than to have his very sense of self questioned by reality. But in this sense, it's a redeeming punishment, because it's an honest one. For me, it helped to visualize the three parts of this book as representing those three stages on the descent to hell. In the first one, Marlowe comes across one of the early settlements in Africa, which, according to the doctrine of the time, was meant to be representative of a civilized land within an uncivilized land. But Marlowe soon realizes that this is not the case at all. I quote, "I avoided a vast artificial hole somebody had been digging on the slope, the purpose of which I found it impossible to divine. It was just a hole. It might have been connected with the philanthropic desire of giving the criminals, that being the Africans, something to do. I don't know. Then I nearly fell into a very narrow ravine, almost no more than a scar in the hillside. I discovered that a lot of imported drainage pipes for the settlement had been tumbled in there. There wasn't one that was not broken. It was a wanton smashed up. At last, I got under the trees. My purpose was to stroll into the shade for a moment, but no sooner within than it seemed to me I had stepped into the gloomy circle of some inferno." Titles, many titles, are given to the native populace throughout the book, and
Soon thereafter, Marlow begins to question all of these, somewhat comically. They're called criminals, prisoners, rebels. And Marlow exclaims that, what more will they be called? This story is rapidly unfolding before him, and this intricate web of lies that has been sold to a Europe during this time is completely unraveled in front of Marlow. He begins to see through the roles that he is playing, the roles that the natives are playing, the roles that Kurtz is playing, and that they merely hide the truth, which is much darker than perhaps he could ever have imagined. The second part of the book focuses on the degradation of what Marlow believes, in that it is revealed to him that it's a lie. He begins by thinking that this is all some adventure, some journey, where light is being brought into the darkness by the Europeans. And we hear that Kurtz believes this too, in this second part. He believes that, and I quote, each station should be like a beacon on the road towards better things, a centre for trade, of course, but also for humanising, improving, instructing. But of course, as Marlow's journey moves on, he understands that none of this is the case. And this begins to pull him down into this spiritually dark place that we mentioned. This lie is deconstructed by the hell that he is within. And in this sense, he and Kurtz begin to become less of themselves, more cynical, more skeptical, somewhat darker. And yet, the inklings of more honesty begin to shine their way into at least Marlow's character during this part of the book. The third stage of this hell is described in the third part by Marlow, following Kurtz's death. Kurtz's last words, the horror, seem to haunt Marlow, who's become obsessed with the man to this point. I quote, it is his extremity that I seem to have lived through. True, he had made that last stride. He had stepped over the edge while I had been permitted to draw back my hesitating foot. And perhaps in this is the whole difference. Perhaps all wisdom and all truth and all sincerity are just compressed into that inappreciable moment of time in which we step over the threshold of the invisible. Marlow talks of Kurtz's outburst as something almost noble. And I would argue that it's noble because it's honest. Because Kurtz has experienced that final level of hell. The final lie has been stripped away. He's not a great man, he's not even a good man. His life to this point has been that of absolute darkness. And in the darkness, he's discovered that. And this emerges from him in his very last moment as a burst of absolute honesty. And I suppose to this point, this analysis is starting to sound somewhat dramatic, perhaps even too spiritual or philosophical for some of you. And I think to some extent it was for me as well. But appreciating what gets us into hell. Dishonesty. A belief in utopia, really, I suppose, comes into this. Thomas More wrote a book on utopias. You also have Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, two books on, I believe, the degradation or perhaps the hidden maleficence of the utopia, of the belief in absolute improvement, in good, and imposing that on others. So I think, regardless of how metaphysical the lessons of this book seem to be to some of you or to me, there is importance in realizing that lies lead to hell, in a sense. And I believe that's what Conrad attempts to convey in this book, although, of course, it's very unclear because the book itself is extremely ambiguous. And the text is quite dense. It actually mirrors the journey into the forest. The sentences get longer, the words get longer, the amount of syllables per sentence get longer. The forest reveals itself to you through the text, which I believe is why it's so hard to read. And I know of some people who've agreed with me on that. I think, regardless of how you feel about the importance of the virtue of honesty, or of what it means to be of honest character, I think this is a topic worth grappling with, and you can grapple with it in this book. Before moving on, I think it's worth talking about Marlowe's own realizations in this. I think he believes he's been pulled back from the line, that he hasn't been able to experience the same amount of redemption that Kurtz has. I would probably disagree to some extent with the character. I think the author describes him early on in the book as an almost Buddha-like figure sitting there in front of the narrator of the book in a meditative position. And I think that alludes to the fact that Marlowe too has had that final layer stripped away. Who he is has been stripped away. But unlike Kurtz, Marlowe realizes he has something of value. In fact, in the very first part, Marlowe describes that he hates lies. And I think this embodies exactly what Conrad is trying to convey, that there is a redeeming value in honesty. And Marlowe has it, just like Kurtz does, to some extent. Although, that said, that line of argument might be contested by what Marlowe does at the end of the text, where he lies to Kurtz's betrothed, I suppose, or his intended. And there's a good argument against Marlowe's full redemption, I think. But throughout the text, I know it has been analysed. Marlowe lies three times, three important times, and I think that many readers, or at least many critics, have considered that those times were of absolute justification. But I tend to disagree. I think, in the hopes that he can preserve something of Kurtz, some element of loyalty to this darkness that Marlowe has chosen to be loyal to, he propagates the lie. The intended is left believing that Kurtz did what he set out to do, that Kurtz was what he believed he was. And that's a lie. That's the moment that Kurtz experienced at the end was his redemption, and she did not get to experience that, like perhaps Kurtz and Marlowe did to some extent. But I think on the whole, Marlowe did go through that third level of hell, like Kurtz did. And I think he did come through realizing that the lies had been stripped away from him, more or less. And I believe that little bit is worth pointing out, but I think you really need to read the book to understand whether or not that is truly the case. So with all that said, what do we get out of this book? I think it could be summed up in some way like this. We all require a journey into that darkness. We all need to have some of the misconceptions we have about ourselves stripped away at some point, so that we understand who we actually are without the lies. And I suppose Conrad argues that once the absolute misery of life is revealed to us, we actually live a better life, because we understand that we're all on the same level. We understand that we all experience pain, and this pain can be absolutely overwhelming, as we discussed earlier in that part about the mentally dark places that people go. There's also spiritually dark places that everyone tends to go, I think. And it's a hyper-personal journey, but also extremely social, because everyone goes through something like that, I think. And so it's actually a very unifying, positive aspect of life, sort of counterintuitively, realizing that life is misery. And I think if you want a more accessible discussion of this, the Stoics are probably good, probably a good place to start. Again, Jordan B. Peterson's probably also a good place to start. I think he talks about the misery of life and that accepting that is perhaps the most positive philosophy that is conceivable. And I think actually on that part about Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, they too also realize that realizing the world is indifferent to you is extremely positive, because it means you can make yourself something good. I think it's encapsulated in one of the very final lines of The Outsider by Albert Camus, which we'll talk about next week. I realized I was happy and always was happy. And this is from a man who's about to be executed, who is a sociopath by anyone's standards, and he realizes he was happy because he realized that life was indifferent to him and he made his own way through it. He didn't lie to himself at all. Very interesting. And it'd be great if you could let me know what you think, because it may sound a bit ridiculous me saying all of this without having any skin in the game, but I suppose this is an opportunity for me to prepare for those moments, if that's even possible, to prepare for hell, to prepare for absolute honesty to myself. And I think, having read this book, it's become very clear to me that there are parts of myself I'm not even willing to discuss with myself yet, and perhaps that makes the mark of a good book, when you realize something about yourself, not just the characters or the author. So, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I think it's a bit shorter than the last one. I hope it wasn't too metaphysical or dark. I don't think it was. In fact, I found it quite interesting to talk about this stuff with you, if you are listening. Please do subscribe to the podcast. Hopefully the next one is just as interesting, and that is on The Prince and the Leopard. This podcast took a little bit more time to put out because I wanted to do a discussion about this book justice, and there are many things I left out, I think. I probably left out the more postmodern look at it, discussing imperialism and slavery and Chinua Achebe or Achebe's critique of the book, which is usually what many critics actually nowadays focus on. You know, is this text racist? I mean, it very well could be, but I think it's quite a depressing way to read books. I don't know, maybe that's a flaw of mine, but I tend not to like reading books with politics in mind, in a sense, but it's a different kind of politics, isn't it? Postmodern interpretations of texts. And I believe in high school that's how I was taught to read, you know. When I read The Outsider, what were the Arabs doing that entire time during the text was what my teacher often said, and it's like, well, that might be an important discussion to have, but that's not what the book is about, is it? Is it about serving an imperial narrative? I mean, is that all there is to it? You know, I like to think it isn't, but then again, I'm in a very different position to some other people who might have a different view. I think that very complicated discussion is going to come up when we talk about the Communist Manifesto and the Gulag Archipelago. So look forward to that. Thank you for listening. I hope that I'll be able to get back to you about Apple Podcasts. Hopefully that comes up later this week, and then you can all stop complaining about the pause play sound on Anchor. So, until then, thank you for listening to the second episode of the Checked Out Podcast with me.